Testing. 1, 2.
Judge of the main points of my approach to perception, more particularly visual perception. I'm writing a book at the moment, about half through, called An Ecological Approach to Visual Perception. And so what I will do is indicate the main points, and perhaps the controversial points, of this approach. I don't call it a theory, for reasons that you may hear, so much as an approach to problems of perception, particularly visual. There are three main features of this approach that I will emphasize. 1, 2, and 3. One, a new description of the environment, to be perceived. And of course, nothing is new, so I put new in quotation marks. Second, a new, again with quotation marks, a new optics, which I call ecological optics, to distinguish it from physical optics and geometrical optics and physiological optics, which are what you get courses about. There are no courses in ecological optics as yet. And three, a new definition of perceiving. That's what I meant by theory. It's a new conception of what the act of perceiving is, I think, or I will suggest that it is. It's not so much a theory as a paradigm, a new definition of perceiving. And so I'll take them up in order. A description of the environment. I will talk about not the matter and energy and what's talked about in physics textbooks. I will talk about the triad of medium, substances, and surfaces. Then about points of observation in the medium, and then the reciprocity of the environment and the observer. Under the new optics, I'm going to talk about what I call ambient light. Ambient meaning surrounding a point. And the difference between stimulus information, as distinguished from stimuli, and the concept of what is in ambient light. And what's in ambient light is, I think, consists of visual solid angles, not rays. Now, the main thing that I must allow time for is the new conception of perception, of course, which involves the complementarity of perceiving and of perception and proprioception. And I'll try to explain that. If many of you have these ideas in part here, right? Complementarity of perceiving and proprioceiving, self-awareness. The hypothesis of invariant extraction, detecting invariance, which is information. The rejection of the theory of sensory channels, or sense modes. A new basis for a theory of attention, I think. The merely incidental character of the contents of consciousness. A new basis for sorting out the facts lumped under memory. And then if I have time, some philosophical points, an escape from dualism, and new reasons for realism. And if there's still further time, which there won't be, a really quite new theory, I think, and this is what I'm all steamed up about, a theory of how men can obtain information about their environment from pictures, a new theory of pictorially mediated information. What are implications for aesthetics? Well, first of all, about the new description of the environment. As I said, it consists of a medium. For our environment, that's air, not water, or not fish. substances and surfaces. And the surfaces are, of course, the interfaces, the separations between the medium where animals live and the substances in which they don't, by and large, live. There can be surfaces with solids of various degrees of substantiality, or water, which is less substantial, or clouds, for example, which are still less substantial. But if there are surfaces, and if the medium is, as we say, filled with light, that is, with illumination, then the light is reflected from these surfaces in such a way as to specify the surfaces. Now, in a textbook, all you hear about is mirror reflection, geometrical optics, and I'm not even going to mention mirror reflection. I'm going to mention rough surfaces and scattered reflection of light from those surfaces. So we have medium, substances, and surfaces, and there's no reference to matter or radiant light. I'm talking about ambient light to a point in the medium, not radiant light from a vibrating atom, or source, in short, of energy. Now, I will take for granted physics and physical optics and energy and talk about the steady state of reverberating radiation in a semi-enclosed space or medium, such as this room, where there are sources there, or such as the open air where the sky and the earth reflect light back and forth until it reaches a steady state. And let me make the point that there are then, if that's right, an infinite number of potential points of observation in this room or out in the air, some of which are occupied by an observer with eyes, and others of which are not occupied. But any observer, or any number of observers, can put their eyes, if they have eyes, at one of these points of observation, and thereby see retinal images if they are vertebrates. But notice that I will include, and I'll try to make a point of this, I include the seeing of insects who don't have camera eyes without with lenses. They have eyes and they see, but they don't form images at the back of the eye. And the third point I promised you was the fact that this description of the environment assumes a reciprocity between the environment and the observer. Unlike physics, I am assuming an inseparable reciprocity between an environment, which after all surrounds an observer. It's not X, Y, Z axes in space. It's an environment going out to infinity in all directions. But the environment assumes, I think, when you speak of environment, you assume a potential observer. And when you speak of an observer, you certainly entail or require or imply an environment. Now, if there are questions of clarification as I go along, I'd be perfectly willing. I've got no plans for this. I'd be perfectly willing to answer questions. Let's make them at first questions of clarification rather than argument. We'll argue later. So interrupt me at any time if you have a question about what I mean. Now, the new optics, ecological optics. As I said, I imply ambient light and ambient light at a point of observation always has, of necessity, a structure. If it doesn't consist of hypothetical rays, it consists of what I'm going to call visual solid angles. So I'm assuming ambient optic arrays at various points of observation in the medium. And there has to be energy in this light, of course, to touch off the photoreceptors in the eyes of organisms. But I want to transcend that level. I want to talk about a different level of optics. So I'm going to talk about relations or contrasts in the light coming to a point. See, the light coming from a point, the radiation coming from a lamp or an atom, is the same in all directions. It consists of waves or photons. But it has no structure. Whereas the light to a point is inevitably structured, unless you are in the hypothetical condition of outer space, unless you're floating in air with nothing around you. So that's the main concept, ambient optic arrays at a point of observation, and I am always going to be referring to a moving point of observation. Or, if you prefer, the set of all points of observation. I think those are equivalent. For all animals, it's distinguished from plants. They are animate, meaning that they move around. And that means that typically, an observer moves from point to point. And so perception involves a moving point of observation and the transformations of structure, changes of structure, as one moves around in one's environment. Notice I have already eliminated the analogy between an eye and a camera. Because, of course, a camera won't work if you move it. And an eye, unlike a camera, is much better off for moving around. An eye sees better, much better, as I have evidence to show, if you move it around from place to place, turn around your head and so on. Then the next point was the distinction between stimulus information and stimuli. By stimulus information, and that word information is a dangerous word, I agree. It's being thrown around by all kinds of ways. And I don't mean signals, and I don't mean information theory, and I don't mean communication between a sender and a receiver, and I have nothing to do with Shannon and Weaver. I'm talking about information in its dictionary meaning of specification. That is to say, information about the environment means to me specification of the environment. Mainly specification of two things, the surfaces and their layout, and the substances of which these surfaces, of which these are surfaces, for which these are surfaces. So I mean information about, in all cases. And the distinction is that stimulus energy is necessary for receptors or photocells, photoreceptors. And but I make a distinction between receptors, organs, and systems. And I want to talk about perceptual organs and perceptual systems, which the function of which is, as I'm going to say, I'll anticipate. An eye is an organ which is part of a perceptual system for detecting the invariant structure of ambient light. So that's what I mean by information. Will there be questions about it? And finally, what I mean by visual solid angles. My notion of visual solid angles is a regression to the optics of Euclid and Ptolemy. Long before the discovery of the retinal image, Euclid and Ptolemy talked about the visual cone and the visual pyramid, and depending on how they talked about it, which consists of the base of this cone or pyramid, or visual angle, solid angle, is the object, they said, and the apex of the visual angle, solid angle, is at the eye. And they weren't at all clear how an eye worked. Euclid and Ptolemy didn't understand lenses and things like that. they understood perfectly well what they called natural perspective. And natural perspective was optics, was identical with optics for centuries, until the discovery of how the retinal image is formed in a camera eye in about the 17th century. And that got us all balled up, I think. So, incidentally, natural perspective, the discovery of perspective, so-called, in the by the artists of the 16th century, I guess it was, the discovery of perspective was at that time called the discovery of artificial perspective. Because natural perspective had been known up to that time, and it consisted of optics. So in a sense, that's what I'm going back to. Now these visual solid angles that exist at any point, all these possible points in the air, where you could put an eye, you could put a camera, or you could put a bee's eye, and you could pick up information about the world. These visual solid angles, I want to say, are nested within one another. That is to say, there are big solid angles. If you're outdoors, there's a whole solid angle of the sky and the earth, 180 degrees above, and another 180 degrees below. And that contrast, the earth-sky contrast, is the most basic difference in an ambient optic array. And then there are subordinate or smaller solid angles coming from big surfaces, and then still more smaller solid angles coming from littler surfaces like trees, and still smaller ones coming from faces, and still smaller ones coming from the elements of texture of these surfaces. So they're nested. Now, these visual solid angles are, as I said, always at a moving point of observation, so that a cross-section, all the cross-sections of all these solid angles nested within one another, change their form or shape and their size as an observer moves around. So changes of form and size, I will call, and that goes back to Euclidean Ptolemy, I will call transformations of the cross-sections of the solid angles coming to a point. But not only do they continually transform, the forms transform with movement of the point of observation. Also, and this is even more radical, and I've only got around to this recently, these forms are wiped out as one moves around. For example, if you go around a corner, if you go from one vista to another, as I would put it, you completely lose the solid angles that exist in one room, and you substitute another set of solid angles. But the transitions between these nested angles, the structure in one vista to another, are completely reversible and are regular. Not by set theory, but by regularities of optics. So the important thing is that these transformations and their transitions are reversible and do in fact reverse as animals or observers come and go. I'm assuming that locomotion is reversible and that most animals, all animals, if they go somewhere, they usually come back home. So any movement in one direction has a specific change in the structure of the light, and it's reversed when you reverse the path. So that during life, you exchange the structures of the ambient light that you explore. Now, finally, we get to psychology, only now. a new conception of perceiving. Let me refer back to the complementarity of the observer and his environment. That to me implies a new approach to sensation of perception, implies a complementarity of perception, which refers to the world, I think. Whereas the dictionary meaning of perception is perceiving of the world, of the environment, of objects, of external things. And proprioception, which was a term invented by, what's his name? Who invented the word proprioception in 1895? I'll think of it in a minute. There were supposed to be five senses of exteroception and then several of proprioception. And proprioception has to do with those channels of sense that tell you about yourself or your body. Now, what I'm saying is that all perceptual systems have a proprioceptive component as well as an exteroceptive component. And that some information for vision is exteroceptive, that it specifies the world, and at the same time, the changes are proprioceptive, that is, they specify your own locomotion, your own movements. I see my hand moving, I see my head moving, I claim, and I see my forward locomotion in the world, and that's how we can drive a car, because you visually perceive and thus can visually control your locomotion through a constant environment. So the complementarity of perception and proprioception is a basic assumption of this approach. Next, the hypothesis of invariant extraction. That's the heart of the matter in some ways. I don't think we sense sensations and then correct them. I suggest that we extract over time the invariants that specify the substances and the surfaces and the layout of these surfaces of the environment. And if you will allow this hypothesis, then the theory of association becomes irrelevant, not false. We do form associations, but that isn't the explanation of learning, of perceptual learning or development. And similarly, I suggest it makes all the elaborate and ingenious hypotheses of Gestalt theory, which is, I guess, the major competitor to association theory, irrelevant. It means that they are an organization in the brain may occur, but it's not the explanation of perception. Just as the association of images to sensations may, in a sense, occur, but it is not entailed in perception. Next, this approach involves the rejection of the ancient classical theory of channels of sense. The Greeks knew there were five senses, but then they knew really there were more than five, and there's been an enormous controversy in psychology, I suppose philosophy too, over how many senses there were. Nobody's ever been able to decide. And the only basis for a decision was the number of nerves you could count. There's said to be an optic nerve, an auditory nerve, taste nerve, and a nerve to the nasal mucosa up there. And then sometimes people talk about touch nerves, but that really won't work at all because there are no nerves for touch. And the fact is that neither is there nerve for vision either. Those anatomical entities, so-called nerves, consist of outgoing and incoming bundles of fibers. And they're all mixed up, and the actual anatomy of the nervous system and the whole theory of this specificity, the neural specificity of sensational quality to the nerves of sense, has always been known to be wrong. You find it even admitted in the textbooks of neurology that specific nerve energies, as Johannes Müller formulated that doctrine in 18, 12 or something like that. The doctrine of specific nerve energies has never been. It's been an embarrassment to even to anatomists. Because the nerves are anatomical accidents of the way in which inputs and outputs are circularly distributed for a perceptual system. Where are we? Oh, and that involves, so if you give up the notion that the nerves are channels of signals, of channels for signals from the receptors to the brain, with communication between the world and the brain, as if the brain were a receiver and the world were a sender, as if we could telegraph systems between the world and the brain, or a little man in the brain, or whatever. If you give that up, then we have a new conception of the sense organs and the perceptual systems. And there's where that definition of the eye comes in. An eye is simply one of two organs which is set into a head, which is set on a body, which can move relative to the terrain by walking or running or moving about. It's a hierarchy of organs for the purpose of picking up information in life. The fact of two eyes has always been a difficulty, because if there are two sets of sensations from the two eyes, how do they get combined? Why don't we see two worlds? Nobody's ever been able to answer that question. And the theory of binocular disparity has been for 100 years a set of puzzles that aren't clear at all. But if you will allow me to think of the eyes as part of a dual organ in the head in a perceptual system, then it's all one organized system. And forget about the camera. Well, this leads to a new basis for a theory of overt attention. A new kind of attention, really, which has been neglected, as distinguished from the existing evidence about covert or mental attention. There has been, in the last 15 years in psychology, a tremendous literature of what's sometimes called neural filtering. You use, almost all psychologists use a device called a tachistoscope. A tachistoscope is supposed to simplify the perceptual process. And instead, all it does is make the perceptual process artifactual and abnormal and atypical. Because we see with a moving head and so on. Covert attention, or the selecting of what you will see if you have a flashed presentation or display, is very interesting. But it isn't adequate for the actual eye movements and head movements and accommodation of the eye and the contraction or dilation of the pupil and the other adjustments of the ocular system, which optimize, which first of all focus a retinal image, but then keep sampling different arrays, different samples of the ambient light, and fixate, put the fovea on little details one after another in the world. These we now can think of as ocular adjustments, whose function is the optimization of the pickup of information. Not the literal focusing of an image, or the moving of an eye from one position to another, and the unsolved problem of why it is that when I move my eye around this room and the eyes move three or four times a second all the time during waking life, the world doesn't move. Because, of course, the retina shifts behind the retinal image every time I move my eyes. And if the doctrine of sensations were true, the world should move. At least the visual sensations should move. And you have to have an elaborate theory of how the retinal image gets compensated whenever the eyes move. That's eliminated. So we begin to talk about covert I mean, so we begin to talk about overt attention, the active exploratory perceptual system undertakes a whole complex, or is innately equipped to go through various adjustments for the purpose of getting details in light. In my book on what I call the senses considered as perceptual systems, I argued that the perceptual systems are what I call modes of attention. That confused a lot of people because I don't mean modes of mental or internal or filtering attention. I mean modes of external, overt, active adjustments of the using muscles, exploratory adjustments for the purpose of getting more information out of the world. So that I substitute for the modes of sensation, seeing, hearing, and sensations of touch, I substitute looking for seeing, I substitute listening for hearing, and feeling for having sensations of touch. So, this theory of the adjustments of the eye-head-body system is contrasted with the puzzling facts of eye movements. Incidentally, there's an enormous amount of research by physiologists and sensory psychologists on eye movements nowadays. They've been for 100 years. But not because, you know, movements, behavior consists of movements, of muscles. You have to move your limb in order to behave, to move your eyes in order to see. But movements aren't necessary. It's postures that are just as good. The important thing about ocular adjustments, or ocular behavior, if you want to call it that, might be a word for what happens to the eyes, is the stabilization of the eyes to the ambient optic array for nearly all the time, except for quick jerks from one stabilization to another one. So the adjustments of the system are ones which maintain a posture rather than move. Non-movement, in short, is even more important than movement. Yes, and that leads to what I call invariant extraction from the structure of the ambient light. And a word about structure of ambient light. That word structure is a dangerous word, but let's borrow some terms from linguistics. There is a kind of a superficial structure to the light, which I'll call the perspective structure. And that's the laws of perspective, as in pictures, indicate perspective structures, which are more or less in correspondence, but only vaguely so, with the layout of the world around us. I'm talking about the deep structure, the underlying structure which remains the same during changes of perspective structure. And Chomsky's contrast between the structure and the surface structure is very similar to what I'm talking about. When we move around the world and the patchwork of sensations changes all the time, and some of them wipe each other out and the like, there are nevertheless invariants of deep structure, I can list a few later, which actually specify the constant features of the physical, of the not material world, not physical world, substantial world, which is quite interesting. Oh yes. Then that leads to the idea that the contents of consciousness, sensations and percepts, so-called, are merely incidental to perception. Now this is a radical extension of Brentano. If you take Brentano's act psychology and forget about all the elaborate details and complicated rationalizations into which he had to go to justify calling perception an act, and I don't even claim to understand them very well, you come to a rather simple notion in which you maintain that the act of perceiving the world is what counts. And the contents of awareness, consciousness, experience, are incidental. What the function of the perceptual system is to keep us in touch with, in contact with the outer world. And the static experiences that we can describe by introspection are not the heart of the matter. They are not entailed in simple, naive perceiving, so I'm suggesting. Well, I'll go on. I'm just making all these claims, all of which are very argumentative, and I'm sure this will cause arguments. I claim that this implies a new basis for sorting out the facts that are now lumped together under the theory of memory. You see, if you're going to have a sensation-based theory of perception, if you're going to say that sensations are necessary for or entailed in sense perception, classical theory, then perception is of the present, whatever the present is. Memory is of the past. An expectation or imagination, might as well put it, are of the future. And that's terribly troublesome business. It leads into all kinds of messes and all kinds of complications with experiments using a tachistoscope. You can perceive with a tachistoscope of color. Most of you have been a subject for tachistoscopic experiments. You can perceive more than you would think you can, but it's wholly atypical, and there are ambiguities and difficulties. This suggests, although it's still very vague, this kind of theory, that one that perception includes, perception includes awareness of the environment without respect to time, past, present, and future. The invariants, if there are invariants, and there are, of course, invariants, solids are generally invariant, and if there are invariants in the ambient light over time, over a changing array, then perception occurs over time. It's as simple as that. And where does memory then come in? Now, the recollecting of my childhood, say, is an entirely different kind of cognition than perception in this terminology. I claim we perceive the environment. I even claim that in some extended sense of perception, I perceive the hallway outside that door. It was only half an hour ago that I walked through there. I can see it, certain sense. And I am aware of the hidden surfaces of the environment. I visualize them, if you like, but that is not memory. I want to divide up memory into subtypes, is the point. I want to talk about the seeing of the surfaces that are projected to this room. I want to talk about the visualizing of surfaces that are hidden by the walls of this room. I want to talk about the visualizing of the past. But then I'm allowed now to distinguish between that and the recollecting of surfaces that have gone out of existence, and the imagining of surfaces that have not yet come into existence, such as when an architect designs me a house, and I can visualize that house, and I say, oh yes, that's it. I'm going to have it this room, I'm going to have the basement here, I'm going to have the kitchen here, I'm going to have this, and so on, so on, so on. That's kind of cognition, but it's not at all to be confused with recollecting or with visualizing of the sort I have described. In other words, to sort out this muddle of memory into its actual types, and I'm able to investigate them separately, Whereas if you're a sensation-based theory of perception, you have to believe that present sensations, by either organization in the brain, that mysterious process of electrotonus, as Curler called it, anyway, the process of sensory organization supplements the inputs so as to construct a phenomenal world, which never worked. Or, in association theory, take Titchener's context theory of meaning. I perceive the ashtray in the sense of I have sensations. I have a sensation of whiteness and glossiness and a surround that is yellow, and then I have memory images of how it feels, and how it feels hard, and of having broken one, and on and on and on and on. But those are all memories which, by association with the present sensations, cluster around, make a context, and give me the meaning of the percept. That won't work either. It's contradicted by an awful lot of evidence. One other case. Some of you may know the famous experiments of Michaud on what he called the tunnel phenomenon, which has to do with this perceiving of the hidden. I'll try to do it by gestures instead of the blackboard. Roughly, he had a display in which he had a black circle, black disk, which moved behind a barrier, a screen, a tunnel, he called it. And it moved behind the tunnel like that. And then a little later, it came out on the other side. Now, Michaud just showed this display. There are two edges here, you see. The object goes behind the edge and comes out. It is occluded and then disoccluded. Notice it doesn't transform. It changes shape in a very peculiar way. Structure changes in a way that is quite different from any other. What you perceive, even children, is a solid object going behind a screen, an opaque, a barrier, a screen, a projected surface, and then coming out from behind. And, said Michaud, you almost see the object behind the tunnel, or behind the screen. Almost see. And that's perfectly true. The vividness of the experience depends in part on the duration of the interval during which the object is occluded or hidden. But the shorter the interval, the more you see it, the longer the interval, the more you have to visualize it, or maybe something of that sort. But what Michaud pointed out was this is sensationless perception. This is one of my, what I consider, proofs that sensation is not entailed in perception. What Michaud called it was amodal perception. That is, the perception of the black disk behind the screen had none of the modal qualities of visual sensation. It wasn't black, it wasn't brown, it had none of the characteristics of a sensation, and yet you perceived it. And I think that's impressive evidence. I really didn't finish. I think that this gives us an escape from dualism. Either metalism or idealism on the one hand, or behaviorism or materialism on the other. It seems to me that psychology is ready for, instead of fighting about behaviorism versus metalism, instead of, if we're going to give up behaviorism in America, and I hope we do, let's not regress back to the metalism of the 19th century, which was even worse. Oh, for example, as good a psychologist as George Miller of Harvard recently said, let's see if I can quote him. He said something like this in a chapter in a recent book. Everybody knows, said Miller, that in perception, what we do is slice up and categorize our experience and then store it away in our memory. Everybody knows that's what happens in perception, he said. No, I challenge that. I don't know that. Why is that the only alternative? That's neo-mentalism. That's a regression to E.B. Titchener, or to Wundt, or to 19th century mentalistic psychology. Now, George Miller, of course, doesn't agree with Skinner that we should throw that all out, or we do perceive, and Skinner can't handle that. But let's have a new basis for perception, which is neither mentalistic nor behavioristic. And finally, I think we have new reasons for a certain form of realism in psychology, in epistemology, I should say, on this basis. That is to say, we can talk about direct pickup of information or extraction of the invariants over time without having a process of interpreting the sensations by past experience or of organizing the sensations together into a gestalt, together with the traces of past experience in some complicated gestalt organization. We have a form of direct, or if you like, naive realism. We seem to see the world as directly as anyone could. I see you all almost as directly as I touch the table. I see no difference between the directness of my feeling this table and my seeing of all of you. And I now have a justification for that naive feeling. It's not, of course, based on sense data, since this is a theory of information-based perception, not a theory of sensation-based perception. And lastly, I will say something about pictures. I do agree that there's such a thing as mediated perception, but that's now relegated to perception mediated by pictures and images, and of course by talk and writing. Men, and I think, as far as I know, only men, have got where we have got by means of the accumulated wisdom of the ages, you know, culture, libraries, and above all, pictures. Libraries only go back to 6,000 BC, but pictures go back 30,000 years, and men have been making pictures in the caves and otherwise for a long, long time, and thereby telling other people what the artist has seen but the other person hasn't seen. And when those ancestors of ours went into the caves with their torches and they saw on a wall, here was, to be sure, frozen, but nevertheless, here was a mammoth on the wall of a cave. They were deeply impressed, as they should have been, because the experience, the perception of a mammoth on the wall of a cave gave them to think. And I'm not at all sure what philosophy began with that puzzle. But this is then, mediated perception is of this sort, and direct natural perception is the pickup of information. Now, I'm sure you have lots of arguments. But first of all, Professor Clark has a crack at this.
Why don't we take just a very short break for everybody to get a breath there and a drink of water.
Leave that door open.